Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity Podcasts, a programme for those who may or may not be going to church, and for those who are disillusioned with church. On today's podcast is a vicar whose video of him holding short Sunday services in the streets of Notting Hill, London, went global. But what happened next? What has he learned from the lockdown experience? What is his new book, A Pocket Full of Hope, all about? Gives me great pleasure to talk to the Reverend Pat Allerton. Pat, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate the time and the fact that in a few weeks' time, you're going to hear the patter's tiny feet. How's your wife doing?
Well, I'm not sure she'll come out the womb running or walking, but we will hear something, Martin. Thank you very much. Yeah, a newborn baby girl arriving in 3 weeks' time.
That's going to be fun.
But she's doing what Kirsty's doing well. She's still working, actually. She finishes up next week, so she's quite looking forward to that.
What does she do for a living?
She works for the Diana Award, following up Princess Diana, and that trust that sort of works with the mentor scheme with that, working with young people.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I was going to suggest that you might want to name your new child, if it's a girl, after the Prime Minister, but we haven't got one as of like an hour ago.
I know. I've just been sort of having, I've had the news on in the background for like the last hour and a half, 2 hours, because it's just gripping, isn't it? It's just extraordinary days we're living in. There's no better TV than the news, right?
Yeah. It really is a soap story, isn't it? There's no other ways to say it.
It is. I mean, other than the stark reality that it does impact and affect people's lives, yeah. You know, a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, listen, so also that's fascinating are the five answers you're going to give me initially for the quiz. So if you're ready, fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. And by the way, if you want to get hold of us at all, you can. It's at ogc@accessradio.biz, and biz is spelt B-I-Z. Question number one, young Pat, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Oh, goodness. We play this game on Alpha, like if you could be stuck in a lift with someone, who would it be? And I often throw a curveball out with people for a bit of humour, but also I would be fascinated. But I often say Arnold Schwarzenegger. Growing up as a young boy, I was a big fan of his work, of his biceps and his films. You know, I mean, he was a hero, but also like just fascinating, like what he's achieved, you know, that he conquered bodybuilding. He had a plan from a young age, what he would do, that he'd head over to America, he'd conquer Hollywood, which he did, and then he'd move from Hollywood into politics. Mm-hmm. And he basically went as high as he could. I think if he was allowed to become president, he probably would have. So yes. He's one of them. If not him, I don't know, some other player, you know, bigwig like Henry VIII, he would have been quite interesting to hang out with.
Yeah, there's a thought. There's a thought. Yeah, good answers. Okay, question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable?
Yes, my favourite character, I think, is Peter. He's certainly the one I think I empathise with the most. My church in Notting Hill is called St Peter's, so that is a nice touch. But I've always connected with him. I just think he's, he makes lots of mistakes. He puts his foot in his mouth, but he's also bold and courageous. I think he gets given a hard time. You know, I mean, no one else was trying to walk on water or get out the boat when he began to sink.
Yeah.
And of course, he gets a bad rap for denying the Lord three times. But then where were the other disciples? They weren't in the courtyard. They didn't even have the chance to deny the Lord. So fair play to him for that, I think, following the Lord that far into enemy territory. But He's an amazing guy. You know, he's leader of the church, the early church. He was the preacher on the day of Pentecost, a big preacher. You know, my heart is to preach. So I love Peter.
Great answer. Thank you. Question number three. if you were Prime Minister for the day, you could well be, actually, and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
Well, I think today, if that was today, it would be that we need to have a prime minister who's in power and position for longer than 45 days.
Yeah.
that might be a law I'd bring in. But no, I think I would bring in a law that every month there was a day when we had to be, it was illegal to be on your phone when you had to put your phone down. And maybe once a quarter, there would be a week where you weren't allowed to use your phones, and social media and all of that stuff. That'd be quite interesting. It'd be a good study to see what that did.
It would mean the kids would have to talk to their parents as opposed to just going, ugh, or whatever they.
Well, yeah, or increasingly parents would have to talk to their kids, I think. I mean,
Yeah,
it's like goes
exactly.
both ways,
He
doesn't it?
does indeed. Absolutely. That's a good law. Thank you. Question four, outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out, Pat?
Oh, wow, yes. Did I plot this family events? Enjoyable day out. Have I done anything recently? I think just any day that gets me out. I mean, obviously, holidays out into the sunshine. I went out driving through the Joshua Tree Desert. That comes to mind
Oh,
once,
wow.
and camped one night when I was traveling around California some years ago, and a little woke up one morning in the desert and went to the washrooms, came back to my bell tent, small, I mean, very small dome camping tent, and a hummingbird had flown in there and was hovering under the sort of air vent at the top. And I just sat under it, this thing, and watched it, and it was just incredible. Then put my finger up, and it landed on my finger.
Wow.
So that was a real high nature point for me. But probably any of those days traveling around California, that wasn't bad.
When you say Joshua Tree, I immediately think of U2. Are U2 fan by chance?
Yeah. I mean, as much as the next person, probably know more. But yeah, a lot of good work they've produced.
That'd be great to camp outside. And I take it there weren't any street lamps, so you had complete naked night lights up in front of you and just see the sky and everything else.
Yeah,
Yeah, brilliant.
exactly.
Brilliant. Question five. What's been your most embarrassing moment, Pat?
Oh gosh. What have I done on that front? Sheesh. Nothing's coming to mind. I forgot. I read over these questions last night, Martin, and I meant to bring to mind something. I mean, I'm constantly embarrassing myself, like Peter, putting my foot in my mouth, using people's wrong names occasionally. I went around my friends the other day. Like, this was embarrassing. Like, real dear friends of mine and their firstborn, he's up. I know she's called Ivy, and I just somehow called her Lily. And that was just, I hate getting people's names wrong, and I hate it when people get my name wrong. So that was like quietly an embarrassing moment. But yeah, if I think of something later in the show, I'll drop it
Thank you. I know what you mean, Dave, on that. I know what you mean. Thank you.
in.
Well, you've said already about St. Peter's Church. Just paint a picture for those of us that haven't been to Notting Hill, and I haven't been to Notting Hill since about 1979, 1980. So, describe what your church is like, please, sir.
Do you mean physically
Yeah,
or?
physically, and everything else that goes along with the church.
Yeah, so it's a beautiful late neoclassic design church, one of the last ones in London, actually. It's grade two star listed building. It's worth a Google, actually. It's a stunning sort of facade that looks a bit like the city of Petra, sort of carved into rock.
Oh, wow.
So it's a real beacon on sort of a top of the hill, with a beautiful tower. So it's like got an orange sandstone facade, and inside it's equally beautiful, with sort of colonnades and a gallery, and a far end with an apse and sort of half dome over the apse with a sort of writing that goes up over the dome saying, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the Living God." So Peter's words, obviously, and then a mural, which is actually a mosaic of Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper.
Oh, wow.
So it's a stunning with like wooden floors. So it's a beautiful building. Yeah, so a real privilege to be there.
Fantastic. And is this your first church? Has been the.
It's my first gig as vicar as incumbent. I was
Yeah.
associate vicar at my last job, so still have my training wheels on.
your stabilizers. What church did you come from then, Pat?
It was called St. Dionys in Parsons Green. And before that, I was at Holy Trinity Brompton. So I've sort of triangulated Hyde Park and West London. Haven't gone too far at this point.
Yeah. Great stuff. Well, as I said earlier on in the introduction, that you know, it went global, the video of you holding street services. What made you do it in the first place? The video, you know, and what did you think about the chap videoing it? What was it all about to you?
Well, this came about in lockdown, the very first lockdown in the pandemic, when the rule had gone out that you know, no public gatherings were going to happen, that churches weren't even going to be able to open, so there'd be no worship, no gatherings, no prayer. And I was locking up my door sort of behind me for the last time pre-pandemic and stepped out on the pavement. And I just remember this thought coming into my head. Well, if people can't go to church, you know, maybe the church should go to the people. And sort of the thought being, what, and more specifically, the thought came into my head, what if I headed to the streets of my parish? I was thinking just parish based at that point, just and took a hymn and a prayer. What if I took a loudspeaker, played a beautiful hymn, and then led the Lord's Prayer afterwards and lifted spirits, pointed people to the God who loves us, you know, the Good Shepherd who walks with us through the valley of the shadow of death, which we were all feeling at the time, and people were increasingly anxious and fearful. What if I went around my parish just saying, look, you're not alone. God is here, God's with you, but also we're here, the church is here, we'll get through this, see you on the other side. So I sort of had that thought of like, well, why don't, yeah, I'm going to do that. And I've always been pro getting out and getting out the four, outside the four walls of the church and being public, being visible, showing the world that the church is alive, that Jesus is alive. So it was right down my up my alley, you know. And yeah, decided I'd do that. So one day gathered the kit together with my housemate at the time. It's before I was married. So I was living with a good friend called Chris. He came and got the tech together. He was techie. And we drove out onto the Portobello Road and plugged in and not knowing what to expect. And yeah, honestly thought, maybe we'll get shouted down and rotten tomatoes thrown at us. And, you know, but so be it. You know, felt cool to do it. Did it and was just, hugely surprised by the response locally. Yeah, even on that street where sort of ripples of applause and whoops sort of kicked off, and people, I guess we all knew we had a common enemy, didn't we? This was the thing. We had this common enemy of COVID and oppressing us all. And I guess this was seen as a moment of, you know, fighting back, taking a stand, you know, declaring hope where there was so much hopelessness. And sort of, the rest went, it's sort of in this social media age and everyone's a sort of photographer and a cameraman or woman, videos taken and footage got out and the national press got involved and wider press got, you know, it's just extraordinary. Like, I mean, okay, let's be honest, I guess the press didn't have much to write about at that point. There wasn't much going on other than COVID.
Yeah.
It's not like the Prime Minister was resigning every day.
No.
So this was a good news story. And so a lot of them chose to run with it and just like, oh, what's going on over there? Let's hear about that. So yeah, an extraordinary wave to sort of surf.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that was a good news story by the press, because quite often I would have thought the press would be antagonistic. Oh, here goes another Bible puncher or whatever. And, you know, want to put the alternative side to it, which they have done in the past, of course. What kind of bad vibes did you get from the press, if any at all?
Remarkably, I didn't get any from the press. Wow. I think it just, you know, I know a bit about PR and I mean, we all do, you know, like what will fly, what won't, what would be a good look, what wouldn't. And I guess they just knew, do you know what, there's not much to hate about this, other than it being very loud invasive, you know, for people on this. And yeah, I got some pushback and people saying, look, not sure about that, I didn't appreciate that. But the press, I think it's quite hard to bash, you know, a vicar who's going around on a tricycle playing a hymn and leading a prayer and a moment's silence for the NHS and for the sick and the dying and those who are grieving.
Yeah.
And just looking to lift spirits and bring a bit of hope. I mean, it would be a bold media outlet, I think, who chose to go into bat against that action, as even if, you know, beyond it, they're very anti-Christianity or religion or think the church has done terrible things, yeah, which of course it has, you know, and there is truth in elements of that. You know, I just think they probably recognize, oh, look, this is a good news story. We can afford to, you know, big this one up before we get back to the usual job of tearing down faith and attacking religion.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So that's my thinking on it.
Who is the furthest journalist in the world to contact you, or TV station to contact you regarding this story, Pat?
I did a piece with, to actual camera, I did a piece with Israeli, like new second biggest Israeli news channel.
Wow.
But I think it was appeared, like the story, you know, appeared on the news in Hong Kong. I know it was going around China. Someone said a friend in Russia heard about it. Jamaica. It was, yeah. I think it was just, you know, like Christians around in probably most nations heard about it. But yes, then we all know the Christian bubble is a lot smaller than the world's bubble, so to speak. But yeah, it was on Turkish news, Austrian news interviewed me. It was on in France. I mean, I think there was a little something. I don't know if it made it in America. There was America, one of their big news channels, I forget which one it was now, was going to come and follow me and, you know, come on the streets and film it on one of the streets. And they sort of had to pull out the last minute. So that didn't quite happen. But I'm sure informally it got, you know, hit America. Even friends of mine who were over there who knew. So, yeah, quite a surreal thing, really.
Now, the video that I saw, how many times did you actually do this in different streets?
I did it. Well, I went out 64 times, basically.
Wow.
I mean, a few streets, like Portobello Road, I probably did 3 times throughout the time. And so a few places I did more than once. But most of the time, I was going around one-off places, you know, in streets. And then I started going to hospitals and hit a few hospitals, because a friend contacted me and said, look, you need to go to hospitals because that's where people are sick and dying. Yeah. And I was like, that's absolutely right. So we went there. And that's the interesting, like, we did it outside Charing Cross Hospital, and someone who lived on a street nearby came outside their front door and just filmed. All they could see was the hospital, and they could hear this sound, beautiful music, but they couldn't see me or the speaker setup. So it was like this, their Facebook post. And this is like someone who's got 180 friends on Facebook, took this video, put it up saying, heavenly sounds over Charing Cross Hospital. And their video, like, so far, has been watched like over 5 million times. So that's the one that more went viral, I think.
Yeah.
And just like, which I love that I didn't even feature in it, and like no one knew where it was coming from, but just Amazing Grace was heard with the backdrop of the hospital. And that's the sort of thing. It was, I just think God was using it to touch hearts, and even using that beautiful piece of music and amazing lyrics.
Yeah.
To open people up.
Yeah, it's amazing, because I don't like social media, to be perfectly frank. But this shows you how social media can be really good, can't it? Because it was a lovely story to go around. But also, I would have thought that it would make other Christians think up, well, actually, if a vicar in Notting Hill can do it, why can't I do something similar as well? What knock-on effects have you heard from other people following suit?
Well, I mean, it's a long time now ago, but I mean, I definitely, there were definitely a number, I think, who went out on the streets and got in touch to say, look, we're seeing what you've done. We're doing it ourselves, you know, in Cirencester, or there's a guy who did it in some valley, I think, in Wales. And there's beautiful footage of someone filming it, walking back across the hills to this town, you know, that's in the dip of the hills. And you can just hear Amazing Grace echoing all around the hills, covering the whole town with its sound. So there were lots of people, I think, who sort of followed the model and or tweaked it, did their own thing, which is like fantastic. I was like, yeah, go for it. Great.
Yeah. And what about the people in the streets themselves? What feedback have you had, apart from them coming to church, of course? What feedback did you get from them?
I mean, on the whole, people responded incredibly openly and warmly and often emotionally to it. You know, I did get some pushback. You know, I got unplugged a couple of times, got sworn at.
Oh, did you?
Once the chap actually didn't look like he was that well, bless him, before he went into his sort of building. But yeah, I reckon, you know, it's not everyone's cup of tea. We should expect opposition for the gospel and for doing stuff, especially, you know, one woman came out like, do you have any idea how disruptive you're being? And I was like, in my head, I was kind of like, yeah, I do. But then I said, look, we'll just be 5 minutes, and then played the song. And halfway through Amazing Grace, she came out and intercepted my extension leads, which I was using at that point, plugging into a friend's house at that point on the first floor. And she saw the join and she just disconnected it, and the sound just went, and that was it. So I shouted apologies to the others who were enjoying it and said, look, let's just end with the Lord's Prayer. Because I respect it. Like, people have a right not to enjoy it. And if people don't like it, I won't insist on playing it. Another time I got unplugged and by a guy who was quite aggressive. Like, he had his arguments against the church and history and oppression of women and slavery and blah, 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 some of the stuff and evils down the years, making a lot of good points. So he came and unplugged me at one point. But his community, this was on a council estate, like, there were about 30 of his community gathered outside enjoying the singing and the music. And he basically got sort of shouted down by his own community. Wow. And by one woman, who, it was 5 p.m. in the afternoon, and she was like dressed in her dressing gown and slippers. And I don't know if she was ready for bed or whether she'd been dressed that way all day. But, you know, they said, no, put it back on and we want one more song. So I actually ended up playing two songs there. But other more sort of touching, powerful moments was, yeah, hearing from lots of people who just found it so emotional and they don't know why. They're like, often endless messages like, that I'm not religious, but, you know, that's really touched me. And the comments on the Facebook video, the 5 million viewed Facebook video, just like, wow, goosebumps, like, I'm in tears here, you know, what's going on? I just think the Lord used it. And I heard directly from people like a nurse in Charing Cross Hospital who wrote saying, thank you so much for playing that yesterday outside Charing Cross Hospital. At that point, I was inside treating a woman suffering from COVID who went on to lose her battle with it. And the peace it brought me and her in that moment, you know, was so special. Thank you so much. You know, another woman who said, my uncle was in there all alone and he died the next morning from COVID. And it's like, and she said, I'm not religious. My family were not religious. But to think that this song was the last thing he heard on this planet, you know, brings tears to my eyes and warmth to my heart, you know. And yeah, just stories like that, where you just feel, you know what, I just think something deeper going on here and the Holy Spirit's doing something and using something.
Yes, yeah. Well, it brought goosebumps to me when I saw the video for the first time and I thought...
Which video did you see, Martin?
I saw the one where you were going down a side street and the typical Notting Hill, really nice terraced houses, either side, and your mate was getting extension lead and going into somebody's house and bringing it back out again, and then you saw the car being opened up and out came your basic PA, that one.
Yeah. Okay. That might have been the very first one, the Portobello Road.
Oh, that was actually the Portobello Road, was it?
Well, it might have been. There was another one that went really... My friend filmed it and it went Twilly Street, it was called. And that went sort of Christian viral, I call it, in the sense that I think all Christians were forwarding it to their mates. And,
yeah.
And that was exploding. And then, unfortunately, his wife then accidentally deleted the video off her Facebook, which meant that it was lost from any device. So it probably would have gone even further, but had she not accidentally deleted it.
Oh,
but
wow.
It had still gone. You might well have seen that one, which was also nice.
Yeah, because I remember vividly there was somebody across the side of the road and must have been flats or something, or maybe not, and they just opened up the top of the window and stuck their head out to watch what was going on from...
Yes.
From a grandstand seat sort of thing. Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, ask me this then, Pat, and then we'll move on to your book and other things as well. But the power of the media is one thing. The power of rumours and myths and everything else is another thing. And although I didn't know you at all at the time, and little did I realise that I was going to be doing podcasts as well. I heard the story that you were immediately taken off air, for want of a better word, and you weren't to do it again. What actually happened from a church point of view, please?
No, that's not true. I mean,
excellent.
It was, I was blessed that I had the amazing Bishop Graham Tomlin, who heads up St. Melitus College and has written many books. And I've known him many years, and he was sort of like he trained me at St. Melitus theologically, St. Melitus College, but also worked with him at HDB on one of the sites there for a year. So I knew him very well, get on very well with him. And he is my bishop. So I think he was slightly tasked with the job of just keeping an eye on things.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is true that there were, some other local ministers. The weird thing is, like, the biggest opposition that came my way or that I heard about or people who wanted to actually stop it were fellow ministers.
Really?
Other churchmen. I'll be honest, like we see things differently, we go about things differently, myself and those chaps that I know of and others that I don't know of. They disagree with the way I do things. I disagree vehemently with lots that they stand for and lots that they do. Mm. So I find it extraordinary, I do find it extraordinary that they would want it stopped and disagree, completely with their arguments. But they would make an argument which would, according to them, is it an essential journey? Is it this? Is it that? They had grounds for making a case, which unfortunately, in the political world we live in, and the church is political too, just means the case needs to be considered and conversations needed to be had and people needed to be kept happy. It just meant that I was every now and then, having a conversation with Bishop Graham where he'd be like, look, he really wanted to keep it going and defended me and protected the ministry. He was like, look, we'll be able to keep this going, but we just need to be wise as serpents. We need to be clever about this, so yeah, there were just various things. Like initially I was going in my car and it was like, look, just don't drive because it's not probably an essential journey. So I said, can I go on a bicycle? And he's like, yeah, daily exercise. So I started going on a bicycle, and then he's like, well, there's complaints coming in that you're just going into other people's parishes. Have you got their permission? So I was like, no, not normally. So he's like, just get their permission and then you can go. And then he's like, oh, you probably can't go south of the river because that's a different bishop's, So it was things like this, which, yeah, I'll be honest, there's some stuff, there's a lot that goes on in the Church of England that I just put my head in my hands, and a lot of us do. And it's like, it does need, it's to step up. It's like, we need to take risks.
Yeah.
We're not in an age where more caution is needed. More risk taking and courage is needed. But I'm grateful to Bishop Graham, hugely grateful that he was always, had my back, and was always thinking of solutions to keep the show on the road, so to speak. And these other ministers, just God bless them, Lord, meet with them, refresh them, revive them, and use them. But it's just extraordinary that I think those are the only complaints. Like, you got a secular media that's sort of embracing it, celebrating it, and saying, wow, what a good thing. And you've got other Christian ministers sort of saying, this should be shut down immediately. It just tells you a bit, about the church, doesn't it? And some of those within it.
Well, do you want to encourage me out of this? Oh, by the way, if you could stay still a bit more, because you seem to be going off the microphone from time to time. That's just a bit of a housekeeping thing there. But what encourages me from this is the fact that you've, as you have already alluded, you had a really positive thinking bishop who was able to think outside the proverbial box. And that is really good to see that, what you're doing is essentially is great. The ministers that complained, how many have actually come back to you and said, well, actually, I'm really sorry, I was wrong, you were right?
Well, I haven't heard from any of them.
Okay, not yet. Maybe after this podcast, they'll come back. Maybe. But it's something actually you also said, this about risk-taking. And I was talking to our own vicar about this only a couple of months ago, that the Bible says about risk-taking. And he said, chapter and verse. And of course, I then go to my NRV student Bible, and of course, what I was sort of right, because the study Bible I was using in Timothy, they had a big chapter on what Timothy was all about and who he was, and that he was about taking risks. So he doesn't actually quote risk taking in the scripture, but it was about taking risks, and I think risk taking, is important today, obviously to be done, within the confines of certain things. Just explain more about what you mean by risk-taking, please.
I think just getting creative with, thinking outside the box, and recognizing, we've got the most amazing message, the best news there is, but it's not news or a message that the world always wants to hear. And we can't, as Christians in the church, expect an easy ride. Or, I'm realistic enough, I don't expect for the rest of my life good write-ups in the press. Mm. At some point, that lion, it's like playing Daniel in the lion's den. That's how I often felt, going on these interview shows, recognizing, okay, there's a grace on this, but for the grace and favor on this, I'd be torn apart here, like Daniel would have.
Yeah.
And that's the same for all of us, but we're still called to proclaim it and get it out there, whatever the world's response. And that takes, risks. You risk your reputation, you risk how you'll be received and how people might respond, and you might not be popularly received. But it's worth it, and it's too precious and important to keep to ourselves.
Yeah.
So by risk, I mean just stepping out the boat, hearing if God tells you, puts an idea in your head, it means running with that. Just stepping out without knowing. We can't always know how it's going to go or how it's going to be received. So there's always risk.
Was there a particular risk that comes to mind that you wish you'd taken, but you didn't in the end?
Not as such, no. There's always, in general life, I often, there's often times I'm like, oh, I wish I'd spoken to that person then. I wish I'd taken that opportunity or said that. And so those sort of moments, but during this time, I just felt like, it's funny, when you know God's with you in something, you feel this sort of peace that passes understanding. Every time I went out on the streets, all those 60 four times or so. I never really felt anxious or self-conscious. I just would go and do it. And I guess on the whole, I'm quite out there anyway. You know, I don't feel that a huge amount some of the time anyway, but I definitely knew God's hand was lifting off it towards the end. And I did one, I think, went out once after lockdown had officially lifted and people were back on the streets. And it's almost like God gave me grace and he was there and he used it, I think. But I definitely was like, I feel God's covering and hand is sort of gently lifting off this. So that's when I knew, right, that's it. You know, this, it's had its time.
Yeah.
And I knew I wasn't going to go out again.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, in closing this particular chapter, before we move on to something else, how many people from your journeys along all the highways and byways of Notting Hill started to come to your church?
I mean, we've had a lot of visitors and we've got a whole bunch more, but I don't know, you know, I don't know how many it was because of that. I mean, it's certainly like our church, like the name St. Peter's Notting Hill has been in all those stories. It's like, you know, anything talks about me, it says I'm Vicar of St. Peter's Notting Hill. So there was quite a lot of advertising going on, I suppose. But given how much there was and how many numbers read or watch that publication or that news channel, it's not as many as you might think. I mean, it shows like we shouldn't don't put our hope or trust in those sorts of things,
yeah,
because you'll never have enough PR to get done what we need to get done in terms of reaching people. So it's definitely seen a lot of visitors and probably a number who are like, yeah, I heard because of this and I started coming along and now I'm here, but not vast amounts. I mean, we're a church, we have like, we're averaging a kind of 100 adults on a Sunday morning at the moment and with not that many kids. So it's not like we're not filling stadiums.
Not yet. But that link seemed very nicely to, because you've already talked about COVID and post-COVID. What have you learned about yourself and how to do church in light of COVID, Pat?
Well, I mean, obviously everyone needed to go online. So we went online and did that during COVID. But that's not how we want to do church. I mean, I don't think it's about how anyone wants to do church, really. I mean, everyone's realized the power of being online and being accessible. And you can reach many more people. And when we were online, we were, you know, seeing lots of people tune in and listen, and people from all over the world. You know, we had a regular listener from Argentina.
Wow.
tune in every Sunday morning. And there came a point where it's like, do you know what? We're actually quite a small church. We don't have an unlimited budget and we don't have people with unlimited time to do all the tech and all the, you know, the pre-service organization and editing that's required to lay this on for our online congregation. So we actually had to have, you know, lots of chats about it and came to the conclusion that we're not called to pastor people as much as we love them and want them to flourish. We're not called to pastor people in Argentina. You know, they should be finding a local church, you know, and going there. I'd far rather spend some time helping them do that than continue to lay on what we do so that they get fed through us. That's not church, in my view. And I don't think we should be pouring. We can't afford to. So I made the decision to actually come offline.
All right.
In terms of doing our main service there. Once we could meet together in the building, we still put our sermons out there. We still put on our podcast. We still put what we're doing out that way, but we can't put the whole service out that way. You know, I want to reach people physically. I want the church we're called to gather physically. So I think it brought home to us all recognition of gosh, we really miss each other. We really miss being with each other. It's not enough to be online or be see each other typing and saying hello during the piece. You know, we can't wait to be together again. So I wouldn't say it's taught that many long lasting things other than the value of the truest and best value of being together. But also, like, it has shown, gosh, the blessing of having technology where you can reach out in times when you can't be together.
Well, I said at the beginning, as I say every week on the podcast, that it's called Off Grid Christianity. It's a program for those who may or may not be going to church and for those who are disillusioned with church. You've got your fingers on a pulse of life, right more or less in the centre of London. What do you think is stoking people's fire with regard to being disillusioned with church or just not going to church anymore? What do you think is the main reason?
I think the main thing is people think they're fine as they are. You know, people think, they look at probably Christians around them in their lives that they might know of and think, you're no different to me, and how you're living is not particularly different to me. And it just seems, I think it probably just seems irrelevant, you know. Still, I mean, I wasn't a Christian until I was 18, and before that I wasn't hostile. It's just, it was irrelevant. And you know, people would just think, oh, you know, I play squash, or I, you know, do horse riding on the weekends, you do church, great, you enjoy that. And it's this sort of relativism, isn't it, that people think everyone's truth claim is equally valid. And so it's the relativization of, I think, of truth and claims of reality that I just think people are, and also I just think people are tired. I think increasingly the more content there is in the world, the more people are sort of scrolling and having reels and things fill their minds and heart and eyes the whole time. The less capacity people have for further input. And I sort of think people are just increasingly closing themselves off to, like, I can't go there. You know, I do my work, I do my, you know, relationships, my family life, my hobby, and that's all I've got time for. So, you know, they don't even make time to inquire, I think, a lot of the time, until things shake them up, until things like what's going on now and what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
Where I think they do begin to, like, think, gosh, I can't hide away in my safe little enclave, because even that's shaking.
Yeah. Well, you said you were you became a Christian at 18. So how did you become a Christian, young sir?
None of my family were Christians. I tell it actually in my book. It's the first entry.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a minute. Testimony. Yeah, we'll come to your book in a minute. Yeah.
It was all irrelevant. Nothing meant, you know, faith, I wasn't anti, but it just was, it seemed boring, you know, church, chapel at school seemed pretty dull. The truth didn't hit me, seemed distant. But then I started having big questions, age 17. I couldn't shake them, you know, like, why are we here? What happens when we die? Is there a God? What does he think of me? Can we change? You know, what's the point of everything? So I started looking into, you know, religion and philosophy and faith and asking big questions and quizzing, discussing it with people. My best friend was a Christian. He'd recently become a Christian, so I'd quiz him. And then he started taking me to church, to Christian Union at school, church beyond chapel. And I was like, wow, this is really speaking to me. I think there's something in this. And that sort of grew. And then he invited me on a camp before Easter in my last year at school. And I heard a talk there on the third night on the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. Why was, you know, where was the body? Because the body's never been found. And as this guy explained the rationale and the arguments about, like, why no one could have nicked the body. The tomb was guarded by Roman soldiers. Robbers left the only expensive thing, the grave clothes. the tomb wasn't fully empty. His Jesus's grave clothes were there. His disciples were terrified. They wouldn't have come and nicked the body, you know, and taken on the soldiers. Jesus was genuinely dead. You know, all these arguments, you know. And then you have the explosion of the church and disciples being brave enough to preach and face being killed. Most of them were martyred, you know, 11 of them martyred for their faith. As he was explaining this, I was like, the penny was dropping. I was like, gosh, I think it's actually true. And long story short, went back to my room that night, prayed a prayer to the ceiling, said, God, I think you're real. I don't know you, but please come into my life. And bang, like the Holy Spirit just filled me.
Wow.
And I just felt this love that I'd been looking for that I'd never known. And everything changed.
Wow. And look where you are now, from an 18-year-old saying that prayer to now living in Notting Hill, being the vicar, and the writer, the author of a new book called A Pocket Full of Hope.
Yes.
Tell us why you decided to write a book and what it's all about, please, sir.
Yeah, well, they all say, like, everyone's got a book in them, don't they? So the expression goes. And I guess I'd always imagine, like, maybe I'll write a book. I wouldn't know what it's on and blah, blah, blah. But during the pandemic, and because of, I guess, all the media coverage that, you know, was happening and coming my way, I had some publishers get in touch out of the blue saying, like, Penguin got in touch, like, saying, would you be interested in writing a book? You know, we've published for many of the great spiritual gurus. I always remember what they wrote, including the Dalai Lama and then some other list of names I could barely pronounce. And so I was like, goodness, really? So other publishers too, and a friend of mine is a book agent, so I sought her advice and wisdom. And so we began exploring conversations, and I was like, okay, I could do a book on hope, you know, because obviously you've got a message of hope to proclaim. But as I'd explain, as I'd say to these different publishers, like, yeah, I'd need to write about God and I'd need to talk about Jesus, you know, at that point. And I probably had four publishers interested. At that point, three of them were like, no, that's not going to fly for us.
Yeah.
We just want a general idea of hope. So they dropped out, and I was left with, wonderfully, the publisher I'm with now, Yellow Kite, which is under Hodder and Stoughton. And it's been an amazing journey. So I decided to write a book on hope that looks at different topics, 50 different topics we all face, from anxiety to bereavement and forgiveness to healing, vulnerability, success, you know, lots of stuff we all go through. And it talks about what it feels like and what we all face and how we tend to try and deal with these things.
Yeah.
But things often don't work. And then each chapter, I just talk about the difference faith makes and my own story, my own experience, other people's experience, the perspective, how faith and belief in God and Jesus changes our perspective and brings greater joy, you know, and peace and satisfaction and hope ultimately. So it's a book that's totally targeted at, you know, non-Christians, people who don't believe or not quite sure what they believe, agnostics. I start the book by saying this is a book for the seekers. It's not for religious people or those with faith. It's for seekers, yeah. For searchers. I say, like, I think more and more people say this expression nowadays, like, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. And this book is written for those people, to help make the invisible visible and put a bit of flesh on the bones of what people sense there might be, but they don't quite know what it looks like or what it is.
Yeah. Well, I know, because I'm steeped in pop music and rock music, you know, the number of times you hear about a famous song that was written in 5 minutes, you know, Mark Boland, T-Rex comes to mind. How long did it take you to write your book, sir?
Well, it's a hard one, that, because I got my day job, and so yeah. I was busy working on that, but doing the writing on the side of that, and I think it is a bit like that. I would find it. I'd sort of wait until I felt I was in the zone, and then I'd do a bit of writing, and when I was in the zone, it could flow quite easily, you know, like I might do 3,000-4,000 words a day, and it's 55,000 words, the book. Wow. So I didn't have that many full days at it. You know, I'd often do an evening or, oh, I would do my sort of weekends or days off or, some days in the week. But it happened, I suppose, over 9 months, that from the time I began writing to when I sort of got the draft in. Well, I say 9 months, maybe 7 months. But I don't know what that would look like in hours. But it makes me realize, like, if I had a good concept, if I had a clear concept, I think one would need a couple of weeks. You had a couple of weeks free without any other commitments. You could have a pretty good go at getting close to 50,000 words. But yeah, that's sort of surreal. It's an extraordinary, thing, because it feels very vulnerable putting something out, dare I say it, putting something out into the universe and making it available. And just saying to the world, "Here, what do you make of this?" And we'll wait and see. But I hope it's just done in the tone of, in my style and the voice I've had, the last few years, I guess, which seems to connect with those outside the church. And that's my heart. None of my family are Christian, so I'm always thinking, how can we connect with people who don't have faith? So it's written for those who've got an itch, but and are looking to scratch it.
Well, we'll certainly let you publicize it at the very end again and where people can buy it and everything else like that. But I'm thinking here, behind every great man is a greater critic in the wife or the husband, depending who wrote it. What did your wife think of it?
Well, she's been very supportive of it, and has freed me up. And as I say in the acknowledgements, if it wasn't for her, this book wouldn't exist. She's given the permission to keep doing it, so to speak. Yeah, she's very relaxed. She's very easygoing, Kirst. I haven't actually run that much of it past her. Like the chapter on marriage, I checked with her. She was happy with some of what I said. So she's liked what she's read and seen so far, but she's, I think, looking forward to reading it herself.
Well, just more about the book, how people can get hold of it.
Yeah, if you Google A Pocket Full of Hope, I think the link, or Yellow Kite, you'll be able to find the link through that. Or if you've got show notes, Martin, I don't know what happens. I might be able to send you a link. No, a shaking of the head.
I don't know what show notes are, but if you, I tell you what, you send me the link and I will put it definitely onto when this podcast goes out. I'll definitely put it on there then.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah. So, or if you follow me on Instagram, it's in my bio. I'm the Portable Priest on Instagram, and it's in my bio there. And just today, actually, the PR push has begun, and I did my first PR like post today of all days, like where the quotes from the book that we went with is says, "Everyone's looking for hope. It's just knowing where to find it." And to post that on a day when whatever hope we have in government or, politics is feeling rather shaken, it could be a timely book.
Very much so. Very much so. And just think of the royalties. Just thinking of royalties. Well, listen, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today. One last thing to do, I'm afraid, is to ask you, if that's okay, in a minute, to give us who your Christian hero is. Somebody that hopefully isn't in the Bible, someone that is preferably dead. The reason why I say that is so that in years to come, we know that because that person's dead, nothing untoward has happened since. This has been a BCSC production. Thank you for joining us again, Pat. Who is your Christian hero, please, sir?
My Christian hero. I would have to say, I think, well, probably both of them, Wesley and Whitfield. Those open air preachers, revivalists, and just bold men of God, just getting out there, proclaiming the word in the open country, and seeing thousands come to faith. So, yeah. One of my favorite quotes, I can't remember who it's from, but it might be Spurgeon, who said, if called to be a preacher, who would stoop to be a king? And they were princes amongst preachers.
What do you remember about John Wesley? Because he's one of, the people I'm very fond of reading up about.
I just remember like knowing how much ground he covered. Like, I cruise around in a comfortable Volvo these days that a parishioner gave us, an old estate. I mean, drinks petrol, bless it. Lots of horsepower, but he rode around on a horse
Yeah.
and would often be reading in the saddle, needed to get his reading done and go from place to place,
Yeah.
preaching numerous times each day. So just his commitment to the task and the job,
Yeah.
amazing.
Yeah, it is. Well, I consider Bristol my hometown, a city, should I say. I support the football team, for want of a better word. And for them, for John Wesley to have like three bases. He had one in Fulham, he had one in Bristol, which was where, if you want to go and see the oldest Methodist church in the world, it's right in the city centre, next to Marks and Spencer's. And Newcastle upon Tyne was the other one. I mean, talk about a triangle. The amount of
Wow.
miles he must have covered is just phenomenal. You know, the
Gosh,
stamina of the
amazing.
man. Absolutely. Absolutely amazing. And the other thing was, it's always worth reading up on this. He had real problems about understanding women. That's the thing I always remember about John Wesley. That he. That he the story I remember most was that rather than just ask this nice lady out, he couldn't do that. He would circumvent so many scenarios. And one of the ones was that because he thought there was another suitor involved, he would send her off to Dublin to become a minister there in Dublin. And then he could just jump on the nearest ferry and go over and see her. He was circumvent. He could just come up with so many ideas. And
Extraordinary.
he was. He was an extraordinary man. And Charles Wesley, of course, wrote some amazing hymns. We mustn't forget him. But he was the total opposite. He had a fantastic relationship with his wife, and they had a brilliant marriage, absolutely brilliant. John Wesley, not so,
Not
unfortunately.
so much, no.
No.
Oh dear.
Thank you ever so much indeed for joining us today, Pat. It's been a real privilege talking to you, and for you being just so open about what actually happened all those couple of years ago. And I look forward to your second book when it comes out, and then your third and your fourth.
Thank you, Martin. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye.